So, Judges chapter 13 is where we'll start, and verse 24 is 13, and after that, read right through to the end of chapter 14. I'll just ask Evan to come straight forward and do his presentation on Samson, a young man on the edge.
Okay. Now, I don't know if anyone else has done this before, but when you've come to another ecclesia to do a Bible class, I bet you haven't forgotten your Bible. So I'm using Kate's phone at the moment. I mean, mine is my phone anyway, but it's not the same. So when it goes off, and I can't use Face ID to get it back on, I'm not going to just turn it around and face it to Kate. So, all right. So Samson. Now, something that I think is important to sort of start off with, let's go to Hebrews 11. In Hebrews 11, I've actually got this here, but I just wanted to pick up on what you were talking about before, James. Hebrews 11, I reckon it's around about, I can picture it in my Bible, where it's supposed to be.
32.
You don't even know what chapter or what verse I'm going to. Or do you? Yes, you do. That's the verse 32, that we're going to, because it talks about the judges. And what is really important for us to, I think, just keep at the front of our minds is that Samson is here in Hebrews chapter 11. So whatever we look at over the next, or tonight or the next night, and God willing, into the exhortation in September, Samson ends up faithful. What we're going to see is that that wasn't always the case. I don't think it was always the case. I think it was a work in progress. And that's something that I think is important. A couple of other little things here, like just if we break apart this verse, can you notice anything about the judges that are mentioned?
There's quite a few of them.
There's six mentioned. There's two major judges that aren't. Which ones are they?
Ahab's
one. No. I mean, she's not mentioned, but Barak is mentioned. Othniel. Now, if we're looking at those two judges, there's very, very little about them that's negative in the record. However, when we look at characters like Gideon, you know, who's a bit of a scaredy cat, he doubted quite a lot. You look at Barak, and he was a bit of a scaredy cat too, wasn't he? He lacked that faith to start off with. If you're looking at Jephthah, you know, he's out the back of nowhere. He left because he'd had enough. You look at, who's the next one there? Samson. We're going to see that there's some issues there as well. So if we're looking at those judges, there's problems in their faith to start off with, but they end up as shining lights. We're going to see the same sort of thing here. So Samson really is a young fellow that's on the edge. That's why we called it this. And have you ever met young people that have got some attitude? Not necessarily like that, but sometimes they do. Working at the school, there's always young people with attitude, but they're lovely at the same time. And you've got to say that because some of them are here. Oh, I don't want any questions tomorrow. Okay. But when we talk about Samson and we talk about the character that he had, there's some problems that I think are pretty evident just from a superficial reading of it. He's a young man who had more friends that were outside the truth than were in the truth. In fact, we only read of Philistine friends. We don't read of any Israelite friends. He's someone who wanted a relationship with someone who was not part of Israel. And he actively went out of his way to go and do that. The only people that we read about with Samson are his Timnite wife, a Philistine harlot, and Delilah. And there's some conjecture over whether Delilah was a Philistine or not. Even if she wasn't, she was not the most savoury of people. He's a young man that liked to place bets. Bet 365 on his phone. And he'd be doing that all the time. The honesty that he showed with his parents was somewhat lacking. So there's a lot of characteristics here that we see in Samson that we think, it's probably not the model citizen that we'd sort of aim for. Now, if we had a young person like that in our ecclesias, how would we think about them? How would we treat them? How much time would we actually invest into that young person that was doing those sort of things to try and get them to turn around, to turn to God? What's our attitude towards them? Because this is Samson, you think about who Samson was. He was a young guy. He grew up in Sunday school. He went to the meeting. It was at Bible class. He went to the youth. He just came back from study week. He had a faithful family. They said thanks for the meal every tea time. He knew his Bible, particularly stuff about the Nazarite vow. He knew all of that back to front. So he's someone that's probably not too dissimilar to what we'd expect to find in our ecclesias. And from this point of view, Samson's a very real character for us. But have you ever met someone that comes across as not quite, they're probably more on the edge? They might believe in God, but something about them tells us that not everything's okay. Maybe they don't listen to the talks. Maybe they don't actively want to maintain friendships with other Christadelphian young people. Maybe they'd rather make friends with people at work or at uni. Maybe some of the things that they post online are, pretty borderline. Or sometimes they might just be outright just totally wrong. Maybe some of the abbreviations they use in their text messages aren't okay. And this kind of thing, we know this happens. We know this happens within our community. But when we see that happening, what do we do? How do we think about those young people? Do we want to invest time into them? Or do we want to shun them, turn our back on them, and ridicule them for their actions? Because God didn't do that. He worked with Samson, and he chose Samson to turn, and he turned Samson around to be that shining beacon of faith in Hebrews chapter 11. And God knew every fault, every tendency, every leaning, bias, whatever. How much time did God invest in it? Heaps. How much time are we going to invest in those young people that show those similar sort of characteristics? And I think for me, it's important for us to lay that foundation, because when I look at Samson, I see young people that I've seen for 20 years. And I think about those young people that I've had dealings with at school that have unfortunately not come into the truth. And I think about some of those young people at school that have shown these characteristics that have turned around and are great people. So with that in mind, let's just go to Judges chapter 13. Now, what's your code, Doc? All right. Judges chapter 13. This is going to be a long night if it's going to be like this. All right. Verse 24. Now. Oh, okay. It's all good. That's fine. Okay. Now, there's one thing I need you to do first off. Now, if you don't want to do this, you don't have to do it. But in my Bible, if I had my Bible, this would be what I've done, is I've actually crossed out the words chapter 14. It's not there to start off with. And a lot of the time, the chapter breakups are really useful. In here, I think it actually takes away from it. Okay. So, verse 24. And the woman bare a son and called his name Samson. And the child grew, and the Lord blessed him. And the spirit of the Lord began to move him at times in the camp of Dan between Zorah and Eshtaol. And Samson went down to Timnath and saw a woman of Timnath, of the daughters of the Philistines. Let's just have a look at what this is saying. The spirit of Yahweh moved him when? At times. From time to time. It wasn't all the time. Well, sometimes. And it's like all of us, isn't it? You know, ups and downs in his sort of spiritual journey. And it was between Zorah and Eshtaol in the camp of Dan. Now that is significant. Because where this is, and I should have put this on a slide, but I didn't. Where this is it's actually about the middle of Israel. Now, if you've got a Bible with a map in the back and it's got all the tribes and that, you'll actually see that Dan is right up the top. That was not Dan's original inheritance. That's what Dan's original inheritance is where Samson is. So 400 years earlier, when Israel came into the land, the inheritance that they were given was right smack bang in the middle. But in Judges chapter 1, towards the end of the chapter, it says, but the Danites couldn't drive out the Canaanites, and the Canaanites dwelt among them. Well, they dwelt among the Canaanites, I think is the language that it uses. But then a portion of them actually said, you know, well, this is too hard. We can't take our inheritance. We're actually going to go right up to the top of the country, and that's where we're going to camp. That's where we're going to put our inheritance. And that was wrong, because God had actually said, no, it's here. And Samson's family was a faithful family. They stayed there, right in the right inheritance. And that's something I think that Samson was really agitated by. Because what happens is he's moved with God began to move him at times between Zorah and Eshtaol in this place, and he goes down the hill to a place called Timnath. You know what that means? You've got a pen? It means inheritance. Assigned portion or an inheritance. So here he is. It's like he's been agitated here. And like, why can't we take our inheritance? Why hasn't this happened? And he goes down there. I think he went down with the best of intentions. But he gets distracted as he goes by his eyes. Because he goes down there and he sees a woman. Lust of the eyes. So verse 1, Samson went down to Timnath and saw a woman of Timnath of the daughters of the Philistines. What does he do? He comes back up and he told his father and mother and said, I've seen a woman in Timnath of the daughters of the Philistines. Now get her for me to wife. And his mother and father said to him, is there never a woman among the daughters of thy brethren or among all my people that you go to take a wife of the uncircumcised Philistines? Samson says to his father, get her for me, for she pleases me well. You can almost feel his parents' hearts just breaking with that. But you know what? Technically, it's okay. And if we're going to look at this as a really technical thing, Samson was allowed to marry the Philistines. Because the law didn't say, don't marry the Philistines. No, come over to, just keep your finger there. Come over to Judges chapter 7. Not chapter 7. Deuteronomy chapter 7. Because here it says there's nations that are going to inhabit the land and you've got to drive them out. And of those nations, you're not allowed to marry them. Doesn't talk about the Philistines. Verse 1. Deuteronomy chapter 7 verse 1. It says, when Yahweh thy God shall bring you into the land whither thou goest to possess it, and has cast out many nations before thee. And here he lists them. The Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and mightier than thou. And when the Lord thy God shall deliver them before thee, and shall smite them and utterly destroy them, you shall make no covenant with them, show them no mercy, neither shall you make marriages with them. Your daughter shall not you shall not give to his son, nor his daughter shall you take for your son. Whew. So they weren't allowed to marry anyone that was in the land. Philistines aren't mentioned. Now, if we're going to take a very technical, law-based approach to this, we'd say, well, Samson's fine. However, we know that this is a problem. The quote that I've got up there now is actually, that's from Elpis Israel. And the context of that is really is Genesis chapter 4, when the sons of God married the daughters of men. But the same concept applies here in Judges. It says, they saw, says Moses, that the daughters of men were fair, and they took wives of all they chose. This was a fatal step. Can man take fire into his bosom and not be burned? The sons of God corrupted themselves in marrying the daughters of Cain. Instead of bringing them over to the way of life, the way of the tree of life, they were beguiled into the way of Cain. For sons of God to marry themselves to the daughters of Belial is to jeopardize their fidelity to God. This practice has been ever fruitful of apostasy. While some of the language that Brother Thomas uses is quite flowery and you know, sometimes it's hard to read, I love that passage. I reckon that's just the way that he's written that is fantastic, because it just highlights that it's a problem, and it's always been a problem. And it's for that reason that Paul actually gives the advice not to be unequally yoked, because there's a very real possibility that unequal yoking is going to drag you away from the truth. And I think Samson's parents understood that.
There's three and four in that chapter that we talked about, all the ones that they wanted to marry. Actually, I should have said exactly that. On the side of it's good life. You know, different gods.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's the issue, isn't it? It was dragging them away from Yahweh. So you can see with Samson's parents there, it's almost like their hearts are being torn out. And it just brings home to me, who do we actually get our young people to mix with? It's so important for our young people to mix with people in the truth and have them as their closest friends. Not school buddies, not work buddies, not uni buddies. While that's all fine and all of that, obviously we work with people, we speak to people, we've got to be nice to people. Where are we gravitating? Where do we want our young people gravitating? Now, it's not a surefire way, obviously, of having people come into the truth, but having connections and good, solid friendships within the truth certainly helps. So it's important for our young people to come to Sunday school, to go to youth group camps, to go to study weeks, to go to all those conferences and suburbans and southerns and whatnot. And sharing experiences, and for us as parents to try and encourage that as much as we can. And it can be expensive. It can be expensive. But where would we rather our kids be? Where would we rather our kids be? What I find interesting with Samson, though, Samson didn't have many Israelite friends. Not many at all, actually. In fact, in chapter 14 and 15, the only people that Samson really deals with, besides his parents, are this Philistine girl, his Philistine best man, the 30 Philistine buddies, and then the Israelites of Judah in chapter 15, who almost are a bit standoffish with Samson and don't show that they've got a very close relationship with him. Now, when I look at Samson here and I see him going down that hill and he sees that girl, I just wonder if he had really solid relationships in Zorah and Eshtaol, whether he would have done it. We don't know. I'm just sort of assuming that or surmising that. But to me, that brings out a fairly important lesson of who we get our young people to mix with and all that sort of thing. Something interesting, I think, as well, and if we had an extra class, we would have gone back to the chapter before, but in Judges 14 verse 3, and I've got 3b here. Oops, Judges 14, verse 3. Who does Samson go to? Who does he ask to get this girl for his wife? No. Dad. Yep. Essentially, yeah. Like chapter 13 actually talks about the mother and the father, and when you analyse it, the mum is actually, she's a shining beacon of faith. The dad is not so much. It's probably a bit like Kate and I. Right? Shining beacon of faith is Kate, and I'm just trying to catch up. We'll just keep up. But that's what happens. And what this young guy does is he finds a chink in the armour. Dad, get her for me. And you're right, he was a bit of a pushover in regards to that. And that's what flesh does. Flesh will find any chink in the armour to try and weasel its way into our life. So it's wrong for Samson to do this on multiple fronts, to try and go for this girl. He shouldn't look to go and associate with the Philistines and be friendly with them. He shouldn't look for a wife outside the truth. He shouldn't go and disrespect his parents. And he shouldn't try and compromise his own beliefs and twist scripture to suit his own ends based on the technicality. Now, if that's the case, why do we have verse 4? But his father and mother knew not that it was of the Lord that he saw on occasion against the Philistines. For at that time the Philistines had dominion over Israel. Now, does this mean that God was condoning Samson's actions? Personally, there's a lot of different views about this. I don't think it does. To me, this is saying Samson's still got free will. God's not forcing Samson to do anything, but he's using the circumstances that Samson finds himself in to actually work out his purpose. That's the way I sort of interpret this. Whether you interpret it like that, that's okay. If you don't, that's okay too. So I think this is really about free will. Verse 5, then Samson went down with his father and his mother to Timnath. They came to the vineyards of Timnath, and behold, a young lion roared against him, and the spirit of Yahweh came upon him mightily, and he rent as he would have rent him as he would have rent a kid, and he had nothing in his hand. But he told not his father and mother what he'd done, and he went down and talked with the woman, and she pleased Samson well. Now, if you've heard any talks about Samson before, you've probably seen some of this sort of stuff, which is really just a bit of a type. Take it or leave it. I think there's something more powerful. Samson's response to sin. Because what's happened here in these verses? What's happened? Because they all go down to Timnath together. Samson's separated from his parents. And in particular, he's separated in a vineyard. And Samson was a Nazarite, wasn't he? Nazarite from birth. Which means he can't eat anything or drink anything that comes from the vine. I'm not saying he did, but temptation is right in front of him. And why is he walking through a vineyard by himself, separated from mum and dad? What about the lion? And then going back to the carcass of the lion. Because now, in doing that, the lion's an unclean animal. Samson is now unclean. And he doesn't say anything. He doesn't even tell mum and dad that he's killed a lion. I don't know about you. If I'd killed a lion, I'm telling everyone. Everyone. I'd be walking into work the next day and you guys would know all about it. Right? I'd actually send Anna an email and say, guess what? I have killed a lion. Then she'd say, Evan, you're unclean. Samson's unclean. He doesn't say a word. He doesn't say a word. Why? Now, if I'm by myself and I sin, I'm not going to tell anyone. That's human nature, isn't it? I actually think there's probably two reasons why he doesn't tell his parents. First one, I think, is shame. The second one is actually probably inconvenience. Because let's assume that he broke his Nazarite vow. That's a whole lot of hassle. Because now being unclean and having broken his Nazarite vow, he's now got to go through 2 weeks' worth of ritual. All he wants to do is get down to Timnath. 2 weeks' worth of ritual. He's got to go and offer sacrifices. He's got to shave his head, and everyone's going to know that he's messed up. He's got to go to the tabernacle, which is in the other direction. Now, he's got to go and bring 2 turtle doves or 2 pigeons on the 8th day. So that's more time. Then he's got to bring a lamb as a trespass offering. He's got to start his Nazarite-ship all over again. What a pain in the neck. So he says nothing. He says nothing. And that was his problem. Let's come over to James chapter 5. Because James actually talks about when we sin, not going and broadcasting it everywhere, not going and telling the world, but actually confiding in people. That can help. Now, the 2 people that could have helped Samson the most were mum and dad. And he doesn't say anything to them. His parents were there waiting for him just to say, you know what, I've got a problem, mum and dad. And if he had have done that, do you reckon they would have been nasty to him? Do you reckon they would have grounded him? Good luck grounding Samson. No, they wouldn't have done that. They would have been like, oh, Samson. They'd put their arm around him. They'd try and help him. They'd support him. They'd try and get him to see the problems that he's got and give him strategies to work through it. James actually talks about this sort of thing with us. When we've got an issue, when we've got a problem, talk to someone. Confide in them that that's the case. Now, the context here in James is actually there's about praying for the physically sick, but there's also praying for the spiritually sick. And that's why Elijah's sort of used in that context there. But verse 16, confess your faults one to another and pray one for another that you may be healed. The effectual, fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. And the idea here is that Samson could have talked to mum and dad. They could have put their arms around him and prayed for him as an intercessor between, as it were, between Samson and God. Taking Samson's concerns that mum and dad have heard and then taking that to God. Now, when we put that in our own context and we think about when we've messed up or we've got some sort of problem and we're talking to someone, they're not going to be, you idiot, and slap you across the face. They're not going to do it. They're going to be looking at us with love and concern and wanting to help. And so when we do that, what we're actually looking at is the character of Christ. And that person is actually mimicking Christ in taking our concerns to God in prayer. Obviously, it's all through Christ anyway, but that's what we can see. We can actually see in that person we're confiding in or confessing our sins to the character of Christ, which I think is actually pretty special. So Samson could have done that, but he doesn't. He could have done it, but he doesn't. For whatever reason, he chooses not to tell mum and dad. Back into Judges chapter 14. Verse 8. And after a time, he returned to take her, his wife. And he turned aside to see the carcass of the lion. Because, you know, that's pretty cool. And behold, there was a swarm of bees and honey in the carcass of the lion. And he took thereof in his hands and went on eating. And he came to his father and mother and gave them some too. And they did eat. But he didn't tell them that he took the honey out of the carcass of a lion. It's a case of curiosity killed the cat. Samson's now unclean again. For an Israelite to touch a carcass, they're unclean straight away. So really, I don't see Samson in a very good place spiritually here. Verse 10, so his father went down to the woman, interesting, and Samson made there a feast, for so used the young men to do so. And that word feast actually means The act of drinking. When I read this in the English, I think this is like in Harry Potter, with the magical feast and the cloches and the chicken wings and all of that coming up on the table. This is actually about drinking. This is like a massive Bucks party without the pizza. Lots of alcohol would have been flowing. Now, while it doesn't expressly say that Samson was involved in that, I think the implication is that he was. He wanted to be like them. He wanted just to be one of them. His best man was one of them. His wife was one of them. And now they bring along 30 friends to really bring him into the fold. And again, Samson's Nazarite vow. He sort of disregarded it. The very essence of his Nazarite vow has been thrown away. So Nazariteship is actually, it's not about the rituals so much, while they're important, it's the principles and the intention behind it. When you read through Numbers chapter 6, really the emphasis on it is between choosing things that are holy or unholy, and making that distinction between the clean and the unclean, between the good and the bad. And that's what Samson wasn't doing. He wasn't making that distinction. He wasn't making that separation. Now, when we talk about being separate, a lot of the time we talk about it coming from almost the negative point of view. But Nazariteship wasn't about the negative. It's not saying, oh, I don't do this or I don't do that. Nazariteship was about, you know, I'm separated to God. I'm not separated from all those things, although that's a consequence of that. I'm separated to God. Let's go to 2 Corinthians chapter 6, and you'll actually see in 2 Corinthians chapter 6, there's a lot of references, and I wish we could have done this, but we don't have time. But if we looked at what the Nazarite vow was all about in Numbers chapter 6, the connections between 2 Corinthians 6 are actually quite remarkable. So 2 Corinthians chapter 6. Verse 14. Be not unequally yoked together with unbelievers. For what fellowship has righteousness with unrighteousness? And what communion has light with darkness? Unequally yoked. Like Samson with the Timnite. Unequal yoking. Now, while we make that application to marriages, it's also in almost every other aspect of life, really, and that marriage is just an aspect of that. What concord has Christ with Belial? And what part of he that believes with an infidel? And what agreement has the temple of God with idols? For you are the temple of the living God, as God has said, I dwell in them and walk in them, and I will be their God, and they will be my people. And that verse 15 and 16 there, that's what Nazariteship is all about, being separated to God, making the distinction between the right and the wrong. And then, at the end there, in verse 16, what agreement has the temple of God with idols? Sorry, verse 17. So come out from among them and be ye separate, says the Lord. And touch not the unclean thing, and I will receive you, and will be a father to you, and you shall be my sons and daughters, says the Almighty. There's so many links there with the Nazarite vow. But how do we think about separation? Do we think about separation in the negative, or do we think about separation in the positive? Separated to God rather than separated from the world. They're both important, but where's our emphasis? Are we separated by the places that we go, by the people that we associate with, by the language that we use, by the jokes that we tell, by all those sorts of things? By not doing certain things, are we separated? Or are we separated as well by doing certain things, by being a certain way? By the way that we treat people? Or do we treat them with love and patience and long-suffering and mercy? Do we season our speech with salt so that it's, you know, it's nice? Do we care for others? Do we show help and love and concern for others? Do we show the character of God and be separate in that way? And do we make that distinction between godly thinking and fleshly thinking and how that impacts on our relationships with others? Back to Judges. Verse 11, chapter 14, verse 11. So here he is. He's with these 30 guys. And it came to pass, when they saw him, that they brought 30 companions to be with him. Samson said unto them, I will put forth now a riddle to you. If you can certainly declare it to me within 7 days of the feast and find it out, then I will give you 30 sheets and 30 changes of garments. But if you can't declare it to me, then you give me 30 sheets and 30 changes of garments. And they said to him, all right, put forth your riddle that we may hear it. And he said to them, out of the eater came forth meat, and out of the strong came forth sweetness. And they didn't know what it was. And in 3 days they couldn't expand the riddle. They didn't know what it was all about. But let's just have a look at what's happening. Samson's put this riddle to them. It's a clear reference, obviously, to the lion and the honey. So, but only Samson knows that. He hasn't even told mum and dad. So he reckons his odds are pretty good. No one's going to get this riddle. But the bet was for 30 changes of garments and 30 sheets. Now, these are some pretty serious garments. This is not like just a sloppy joe. Well, this is like an Armani suit. But not just one Armani suit. It's 30. 30 of them. Plus some nice sheets. And this is the first inkling that we get that while Samson wants to be considered one of the Philistines don't actually consider Samson to be one of them. Because for Samson to say to the Philistines, you give me just one sheet and one garment, and they're like, whoa, I can't afford that. There's way too much money. I can't do that. It's going to impoverish us. One person saying that. There's now, because if Samson loses the bet, you multiply what that one person's saying by 30, and he has to pay that. So, oh, that's going to impoverish us. We can't afford that. But they have no problem saying to Samson, yo, you pay us 30 times that, though. If you don't get it, if we get it, you've got to pay us. They will economically cripple him. But yet they're not willing to be impoverished themselves. They don't actually care. They don't care about Samson. Samson wants to be part of them. They don't care. They are not interested in him. So on the seventh day, it should actually say the fourth day, halfway through the week, came to pass on the fourth day that they said to Samson's wife, entice your husband that he might declare to us the riddle, lest we burn thee and thy father's house with fire. And have called us to take what we have. Is it not so? Did I just skip the whole section? No, I don't know. Halfway through the week, they're getting a bit worried. We haven't got this riddle. We don't know what it's talking about. Verse 16. And Samson's wife wept before him and said, you hate me. You don't love me. You've put forth a riddle unto the children of my people, and you haven't even told me. And he said to her, I haven't even told mum and dad. Why am I going to tell you? And she wept before him 7 days while the feast lasted. It came to pass on the seventh day that he told her, because she was nagging him and lay sore upon him. And she told the riddle to her people. She didn't really love him, did she? She didn't really love him because it's her people. It's her people. That's where her allegiance lay, with her people. And if our young people want to marry outside the truth, that's what awaits. My people versus your people. Godly thinking versus humanistic thinking, worldly thinking. Can two walk together except they're agreed? No. The relationship here wasn't close. You'd think, wouldn't you? You'd think that if you were going to marry someone, that you'd tell them things before you told your own parents, wouldn't you? You're becoming your own family unit. But he says to her, why on earth am I going to tell you when I haven't even told mummy? There's no leaving mother or father here and cleaving to his wife. The relationship, it's actually not a good relationship. There's warning bells blaring. Warning bells are blaring.
It was sort of, in the start, really, I mean, it was based on visuals to start with.
Yeah.
He saw
she pleased
his
eyes. That's right.
Not his mind.
Exactly. What's the quote that Nana always says? Beauty is vain and favour is deceitful. I'm learning to. That's right. I'm starting to learn that the beauty is vain and favour is deceitful. Not from you. You're beautiful, and you're full. I am not beautiful. I'm going. Oh dear, this is. It's going to be a long trip up the hill. No, but like, because I'm going badly grey and balding and I'm getting fat. And anyway, I've lost all my good looks. Anyway. Well, see, back to Samson. Okay, he hasn't even told mum or dad. The relationship's not good. And like you say, it's based on looks. You saw this hot young girl down there at Timnath, and she loves to have a bit of fun and live the high life, but he's gone against his parents' wishes. He's gone against his parents' wishes. Never a good start to pit your parents against your spouse. Samson also needed to engage in Philistine practices. He's disregarding his people, and he's now going to hers who didn't actually want him. And she's not really leaving hers and coming to him. She's like a bit of a 40-49-51 situation, because now she's leaving her people and they don't really like that, and all that's going on. She doesn't actually love Samson. There's no common goals. There's no common beliefs. There's no common people. They're not one flesh in mind, in belief, in attitude, in allegiance. And the relationship isn't deep. This whole scenario, though, be that as it may, this whole scenario would be pretty tough for Samson to take. It would be pretty tough for him to take. His fiancée has basically betrayed him. Now, whether the relationship was deep or not, that's pretty tough to get stabbed in the back like that. That would be pretty hard to take. But God was actually guiding Samson through this. God was orchestrating all of this for Samson. And I think what God is trying to do is to get Samson to realize, you know what? The Philistines are not your friends. The Philistines are the enemies of God. Don't go down there, Samson. Don't try and befriend them. Don't try and become one of them, because I want you. You're mine, Samson. And I don't want you going down that path. And I need you to see how bad they are. And what God's doing through these events and this trial that he's going through is actually turning Samson around, slowly turning him around and saying, Samson, don't go down there. Come with me. That's what God's doing through this whole situation. Verse 18. The men of the city said to him, the seventh day before the sun went down, what's sweeter than honey? What's stronger than a lion? He said, oh, if you hadn't have talked to my wife, you wouldn't have got this. You wouldn't have found out my riddle. And so the Spirit of the Lord came upon him. He was angry. And he went down to Ashkelon and slew 30 men, took their garments as spoil, gave their changes of garments unto them which expounded the riddle. His anger was kindled and he went up to his father's house, but he didn't go back to his wife. What we'll actually see with Samson as we go through this is that Samson actually doesn't have righteous anger very often. What he does here isn't actually to vindicate Yahweh. This is retribution for what's been done to him. He doesn't like it. And it's a case of, you did this, so I'll do that. Because you did that, I'm going to do this. Because you did that, I'm going to do that. It's tit for tat right through chapter 14, 15. Tit for tat all the time. Samson tells an unfair riddle. So they threaten his wife. Why are you threatening my wife? You know, I've lost the bet because you cheated. Well, I'm going to go and kill 30 Philistines. And I'm going to go off in a huff about it. I'll be angry. So, no, right, fine. What do they do? Samson leaves his wife in Timnath without consummating the marriage. They give him to someone else. Here, give your wife to your best man. How do you like that, Samson? Before, he didn't like that. So he gets mad and he burns the fields. It's tit for tat, the whole story. And that's how it goes until the end of chapter 15. It's all retaliation. Samson wasn't vindicating Yahweh throughout this. But what God is doing is he's getting Samson to see that he can't be part of the Philistines. He's actually got to be separated to God and really take on what that Nazarite vow actually means. Now, as we said when we first started off, Samson needed changing. He needed changing. He's a young person that was on the edge. But we can see very clearly that it's God that's actually changing Samson. God is the one that's guiding him around. The only thing that man did to help Samson was his mum and dad bringing his attention to godly principles, saying, don't marry a Philistine girl. Now, God is the one who's turning Samson around. No one else. God is the one that's turning him around. And while we might think it's impossible, we might see a young person like that, or we might see a Samson, we think there's no way in the world I can get this guy to turn around and come to the truth. Like, I just can't do it. It's too hard. Not with God. God can do that. God can help that person change things around in their own life. With man, it's impossible. With God, all things are possible. And that's what we'll have a look at probably next week.